that, it might cause the bomb to go off immediately. She probably knew that anyway.
Count of three, scoot to the left. Ready? Yeah. One, two, three, scoot!
They moved about 6 inches to the left along the uneven surface of the narrow trail. The bomb was still wedged solidly between them.
That's not going to work. Pumpkin, can you get to your feet?
I think so, she said.
On the count of three, they tried that. They toppled over to the right the first time. They attempted it a second time once they'd straightened up. Grizzik's foot turned on a loose stone, and they went down again.
One, two, three,
Grizzik said again, and then with a grunt, they were standing. The bomb was still wedged tightly between them.
Okay, Pookie, it's not gonna drop out on its own. We gotta shake it loose.
You're the explosives expert, but I cannot imagine that would be productive to keeping a bomb unexploded.
I think it's the only chance we got.
Me too.
Again, on the count of three, they began jumping up and down. Disbelieving, Grizzik felt the bomb shift. It had been pressing, silently threatening against his lower back. Now it was at his tailbone.
It's working,
Safi squeaked.
I think it is,
Grizzik replied, trying not to be too hopeful. They kept jumping. The bomb slipped lower, lower. And then Grizzik no longer felt the pressure. He braced himself for what he secretly thought was inevitable. Detonation on contact with the ground. But their luck seemed to be holding. He heard it pop on the sand, but nothing else.
We did it,
Safi cried happily.
Grizzy, we...
Quiet for a sec, Grizzik said.
Safi obeyed. Grizzik closed his eyes sickly. In the silence of the desert night, he could hear the tick, tick. The bomb was on a timer.
We ain't out of this yet, he said. Hop to the right and keep hopping.
For how long?
Till we reach Gadget Zan.
They hopped. Even as he believed the bomb was ticking away their lives second by second, Grizzik marveled at what they had done together. Even now they were working together in perfect coordination, the cliched, well-oiled machine.
Grizzy?
Yeah?
Hop, hop, hop.
I have a confession.
What's that, Pookie?
I didn't tell you something I did because I thought you'd be angry with me.
Hop, hop. They were 3 yards away from it now. If only they both had longer legs.
Can't be angry with you for anything now, Pumpkin.
I burned the notes.
Grizzik was so shocked that he almost stumbled, but he managed to keep their rhythm.
You... what?
I tore out all our notes and burned them.
Hop. Hop.
There's no way Gallywix can recreate our experiments. He has a few prototypes and a couple of already mixed potions, but that's it. Whatever awful thing he intends to do with Azurite, it won't be on us.
Hop. Hop.
Safi. Oh, you're a genius.
At that moment, Grizzik's left foot turned on a slippery sand-covered stone, and he heard something snap. They toppled over, and this time, he knew with sick horror that he was not going to be able to get back up. Lying face down in the sand, he couldn't determine how much distance they'd put between them and the bomb, and in the darkness, he hadn't been able to identify the kind of explosive Druzz had wedged between them. Were they far enough away to survive if it went off? He gritted his teeth against the pain as he said,
Safi, my ankle snapped. We gotta crawl, okay?
He heard her gulp.
Okay,
she said bravely, though her voice quavered.
Roll over so we're both on our left sides. That way I can push with my good leg.
They did and started squirming away.
Grizzy,
Safi gasped as she panted.
I still have the ring. My engagement ring.
The ring, made of commonplace ugly metal, and adorned with a small golden glowing drop of azurite.
It might be enough to protect us,
she said.
It might at that,
Grizzik said. Hope, dizzying and wonderful, flowed through him, and he began squirming in earnest.
I got a confession to make too, Pumpkin.
Whatever it is, I forgive you.
He licked his lips. All these years he'd never said it. Wasted, stupid years. But all that was gonna change. Starting now.
Saffronetta Flivers, I look.
The bomb exploded. Chapter 28. Arathi Highlands, Stromguard Keep. Anduin stood atop the ruined ramparts of Stromguard Keep. The wind that stirred his fair hair was damp and cool, and the overcast sky did little to dispel the sense of sorrow that permeated this place. The Arathi Highlands were a part of Azeroth rich in both human and forsaken history. Here the mighty city of Strahm once had stood, and before it the Empire of Arathor, which had given birth to humanity. The ancient Arathi had been a race of conquerors, but they had recognized the wisdom in extending cooperation, peace, and equality to the vanquished tribes. Those qualities had made humanity strong. Those ancient tribes of the Eastern Kingdoms had joined together, succeeding in carving out a nation that had changed the world. Here, too, was the birthplace of magic for humanity, a gift from the beleaguered High Elves of Quel'Thalas in exchange for the aid of Strahm's mighty army against their common foe, the Trolls. All the major human nations had been settled by those who left Arathor. Dalaran, founded by the first Magi instructed by the Elves, as well as Lordaeron, Gil'neas, and later Kul'Tiras and Alterac. Those who stayed behind had built the fortress on which the King of Stormwind now stood. He heard the sound of boots on stone and turned to regard again. The older man stepped beside him, his eyes roaming thoughtfully over the landscape of pine trees and rolling green hills.
"The last time I stood here," Gan said, "Gil'neas was a powerful nation, and Stromgarde's star was waning. Now both kingdoms lie in ruins. This one's home only to criminals, ogres, and trolls. And mine is home to them."
He pointed across the rolling fields to the gray stone of what was known as Thoradin's Wall. Anduin, Greymane, Tyrallion, Velen, Fowl, and Kalia, along with exactly 200 of Stormwind's finest, had arrived a few hours earlier from Stormwind Harbor. It had been sobering to see these ruins appear out of the mists, their stone as gray as the sky itself, more so to stand where they stood now. Thoradin's Wall and the small forsaken encampment outside it marked the farthest point of the Horde's reach in this land that was the birthplace of humanity. Gil'neas was not too far, wreathed in blight, invaded by the Forsaken who had driven Gen's people to become refugees and had slain the king's son. Gen lifted a spyglass, made a soft growling sound, and handed the instrument to Anduin. Anduin emulated him. Through the gnomish tool, he could see armed figures patrolling the ancient wall, just as his people did the walls of Stromgarde Keep. They were all forsaken. Tomorrow at first light, the desolate council would gather at the Arch of Thoradin's Wall. They would march out to a halfway point marked by a fork in the simple dirt road. At the same time, the 19 humans selected to meet with their friends or relatives would approach them. Kalia and Fowl would conduct the meetings. There would be no other Horde or Alliance interference, though each side had agreed to allow a group of priests to fly overhead, just in case. Anduin returned the spyglass again. "I know this must be difficult for you."
"You know little about this," Gen snapped.
"I understand more than you think," Anduin continued. "I have Tyrallion and Velen to assist me." Kindly, he added, "you didn't need to put yourself through this."
"Of course I did," Gen said. "Your father's ghost would haunt me if I hadn't come."
"As Liam's haunts you because you did," Anduin thought sadly. "It will all be over soon," he said. "Thus far, Sylvanas appears to have kept her word. Scouts report that everything seems to be in order, on the terms we discussed."
"If she did honor a promise, it would be a first," Gen said.
"Whatever we may think of her, we must be aware that she is a master strategist, and that she therefore believes agreeing to this will somehow benefit her and the Horde."
"That's what I'm afraid of," Gen replied.
"She's worried about losing her grip on the Undercity because of the Desolate Council, but she's smart enough to know that they're no real threat. So she agrees to one day where the members of the Council only are permitted to meet their loved ones. The Council is satisfied, plus it's an honorable thing to do, and that placates any orcs, trolls, or tauren. It's shrewd politics."
"She could very easily double-cross us and murder us all."
"She could, but that would be a terrible idea. Going to war over this right when the Horde is recovering from a brutal one. When she could be focusing on Silithus and Azurite." He shook his head. "A terrible waste of resources. I don't trust her to keep her word for honor's sake. I do trust her not to be stupid. Don't you?" Gen had no response to that.
"Your Majesties," came Turalyon's deep voice. I've put the priests into position. Per your agreement, 25 of them will mount their griffins tomorrow and be our eyes on the battlefield.
It's not a battlefield, Turalyon, Anduin reminded him. This is a peaceful gathering site. If all goes according to plan, it never will be a battlefield.
My apologies. I misspoke.
Words have power, as I know you know. Make sure the soldiers under you refrain from using that term.
Turalyon nodded.
We've seen nothing to indicate deception on the Horde's part. They appear to be keeping to the proper numbers and holding their positions.
Anduin felt a flutter inside his chest that he quickly quelled with a deep breath. For all his insistence that this would not provoke a war, he shared the worries of his advisors. Sylvanas was indeed a good strategist, and she almost certainly had plans in place that even SI-7 had been unable to ferret out. For the moment, though, he would put aside his apprehension. Archbishop Fowl and Kalia would be conducting a service shortly, and after that, he would move among those who had been brave enough and who loved enough to accept the chance to be reunited with people who would not be as they were in memory, but who would be present. Would be, as much as the Forsaken could be, alive. There was still something left of the old sanctum of the keep. It was more than sufficient to house the 19 civilians who had come to be part of the meeting, the priests, and any soldiers who wished to join them. There were a few missing timbers in the roof, and drops of drizzly rain fell on some of those who had been assembled. No one seemed to mind. Hope shone on their faces on a gray day, and Anduin took heart in those expressions. This, he mused, is how you combat fear and long-held grudges, with hope and with open hearts. Kalia and Fowl waited until everyone was assembled, and then Fowl spoke.
First, I want to reassure you that few people enjoy sitting through a religious service for long, even at the best of times. And today, he continued, glancing up at the gray clouds, suffice it to say, I'll spare you a lengthy session spent standing in a drafty old building.
There were some chuckles and smiles. Turalyon stood next to Anduin and said quietly,
They are still getting used to the idea of a Forsaken priest.
Anduin nodded. It's to be expected. That's why I asked Kalia to participate too. Seeing the two of them side by side, priests of the light, so obviously comfortable with each other, is a good introduction to what they're going to encounter shortly.
Has anyone recognized her yet?
Kalia had donned a nondescript practical dress and a heavy cloak with a hood. Most everyone had their hoods up in the light rain, so she did not stand out. Valera had once told him the best disguises were simple ones, appropriate clothes, behaving as if one belonged. No one was looking for a queen long thought dead today. Not that I've heard. To them, she's just a fair-haired priestess. Turalyon nodded, but still looked concerned. Fowl continued.
Your king has already told you what we expect will transpire, and he has advised you about what to do if a banner is raised at either Thoradin's wall or here at the keep. I wish to avoid tedious repetition, so I'll just say be alert and move quickly. But I truly hope that doesn't happen. I and my fellow priestess will be out there with you. Others will be standing by to lend aid if needed. You may be shopkeepers or blacksmiths or farmers, but today you are my brothers and sisters. Today we are all servants of the light. If you're afraid, don't be ashamed of it. You're doing something no one has ever done before, and that can always hold fear. But do know that you are doing the work of the light, and now, accept its blessings.
He and Kalia lifted their arms, turning their faces skyward. The sun might be hidden behind the clouds, but that did not mean it wasn't there, sending its life-giving rays to those who dwelled on the face of this world. It was the same with the light, Anduin thought. It was always present, even when it seemed to be far beyond one's reach. A golden glow filled the area. No explosion of blinding illumination, but a gentle radiance that made Anduin's tight chest loosen as he inhaled deeply. He had been awake all night, both unable and unwilling to sleep, but as he closed his eyes and opened to the healing energy, he felt renewed, refreshed, and calm. He stepped outside just as the clouds cleared for a moment, and a few lone, beautiful rays of sunshine fell upon the group as they made their way out of the sanctum. This, too, was a blessing of the light. Though simple and mundane, if something as magnificent as the sun itself could ever be called such things. Many of those present, including Anduin himself, had never been to this historic site. They were allowed to roam within the confines of the fortress, though not outside it. Anduin would put no one unnecessarily at risk by allowing them to venture too far. He believed that Sylvanas would keep her word, but neither of them had said anything about spies. He had SI-7 to observe and report. She had her Deathstalkers to do the same. Their presence was yet another reason to be concerned about Kalia, and she was under strict instructions to keep her cloak's hood up every time she ventured outside an enclosed space. Most would return to the ships to sleep, though some had asked to remain inside Stromgard Keep. Plenty of food, clean water, tents, and dry firewood had been provided for their comfort. Anduin watched them as they departed the chapel, some in groups of newly found friends, others in solitude. Some stayed behind to talk to Kalia and Fowl, and that made Anduin smile. Among them he noticed the passionate and headstrong young Filia, who seemed to almost palpably radiate joy at Emma, an elderly woman who had lost so many to Arthas's war against the living. A sister, and her family, and even more tragically, Emma's own three sons. Old Emma, as Anduin had learned some called her, was not the hardiest of women, and her mind had a tendency to wander. But she seemed alert, and her color was good as she spoke first to Kalia, and then, cautiously, to Fowl.
"I have in some ways learned more lessons in the past several months than in 1,000 years, Tyrallian said, following Anduin's gaze. "There's much I have been wrong about."
"Gen still thinks this is a bad idea."
"He's right to worry. Sylvanas is slippery. But no one can truly know another's heart. You have to make the best call with the information you have, and your own instincts. Gen is fueled by anger and hatred. Not all the time, but often. You and I are fueled by other things."
"The light," Anduin said quietly.
"The light, yes," Tyrallian agreed. "But we should let it guide us, not command us. We also have our own minds and hearts. We should make use of those as well."
Anduin said nothing. He had heard of the battles that Tyrallian and Illyria had been fighting for a millennium. He knew they had been devotees of a Naru called Zira, who they thought had epitomized what they loved best about the light. Instead, Zira had revealed herself to be stern and implacable, dangerously so. "One day, soon," Anduin said at last, "I would talk to you about your experiences with the light. But for now, I understand your words. And agree with them." Tyrallian nodded.
"I will share what I can in the hope that it will help you be the ruler your grandfather and father were. And I will ask my son, Arator, to come to Stormwind soon. You two are very similar."
"From what I hear, he's the better swordsman," Anduin grinned.
"Nearly every swordsman I know says the same thing, so you're in good company."
Tyrallian looked up at the sky.
"Still late afternoon. What are your plans?"
"I'll walk with Gen. Have him tell me what he remembers of this place. It will help distract us both. Then," he shrugged, "I don't think I'll be getting much sleep tonight."
"Nor I. I seldom sleep before battle."
"This isn't a battle," Anduin said, not for the first time. Tyrallian regarded him kindly with warm brown eyes, a hint of a smile on his scarred visage.
"Tomorrow you, the 41 people on the field, and everyone watching will be engaging in a battle not for property or riches, but for the hearts and minds of the future," Tyrallian said. "I would call that a battle, Your Majesty, and one well worth fighting."
That night, torches were lit along the ramparts of the old fortress, something the walls had not seen in many years. The warm, dancing light chased away darkness, but coexisted with the flickering shadows of its own creation. The night was oddly clear, and the moonlight was kind to the area. Anduin had wrapped himself in a cape and now stood looking out over the rolling landscape. Thoradin's wall was only a slight smudge of pale stone in the distance. Anduin saw nothing moving there or in the field that stretched between the two outposts. He closed his eyes for a moment, breathing the cool, moist air. Light, you've guided and shaped me for most of my life. And since my father died, I've woken up every morning with the fate of tens of thousands of people resting on my shoulders. You have helped me bear this burden, and I have been blessed to have many wise people to rely upon. But this one's on me. It feels like the right thing to do. The bones that were shattered by the bell are easy tonight. My heart is clear, but my mind... He shook his head and said aloud, Father, you always seemed so certain, and you acted so swiftly. I wonder if you ever doubted as I do. No one save a madman or a child is completely free from doubt. Anduin turned, laughing a little in embarrassment. My apologies, he said to Kalia. You stumbled upon my ramblings. I apologize for intruding, she said. I thought you might want company. He considered declining her offer, then said, Stay if you like. I might not be the best companion, though. Nor I, she admitted. We'll be awkward together, then. Anduin chuckled. He was growing fond of Kalia. At nearly 40, she was much older than he was, but she felt less like a parent figure, as Jaina had been, and more like a big sister. Was it the light in her that made him feel so easy in her presence? Or was it simply who she was? She had been a big sister once. Would it pain you to talk of Arthas? He asked. Before things... Before. No. I loved my little brother. But few people seem to grasp that. He was not always a monster. And that little boy is how I'll always remember him. A sudden smile crossed her features. Did you know, she said, he was once terrible at swordplay? Chapter 29 Arathi Highlands, Thoradin's Wall. Elsie hoped that the Alliance participants in the gathering had had a pleasant journey. It was a much longer trip for them than it was for the Forsaken. The Arathi Highlands were comparatively close, only a short flight via Bat. Of course, a short flight via Bat was still exciting, as she so seldom traveled anywhere other than Bryl to visit some friends. She could hardly believe that the day had finally come, that this meeting was actually happening as her Bat landed and she slipped off onto the soft grass at a site named Galen's Fall. It was an apt name, as the human prince Galen Trollbane, one-time heir to the once great kingdom of Stromgarde, had been slain on this spot years earlier by the Forsaken. Lady Sylvanas' apothecaries had raised him from death's grasp, and for a time he had served her. Then he rebelled, taking his men and declaring that he owed no allegiance to anyone other than himself, and that he would restore Stromgarde to its former glory. Stromgarde Keep lay to the south. One could see it from here. It was still in ruins, and Galen had fallen twice, once as a human, once as a Forsaken. Such, mused Elsie, is the fate of those who would defy the Banshee Queen. A Forsaken handler took the reins and fed the bat a large dead insect, which it chomped happily as it was led away. Parqual was waiting for her, his gray-green lips turned up in a smile. In his arms he held a ratty old teddy bear.
I'm glad you came, he said, even though you don't have anyone waiting for you.
Of course I had to come, she said. I had to see you reunite with that daughter you keep going on and on about. She nodded at the toy. You must remember, Philia's going to be a big girl now. She might be a little old for a teddy bear. Quite a few years have passed.
He chuckled. I know, I know. I'm just so pleased she wanted to see me.
He indicated the stuffed animal.
Brownie Bear here was the first toy I gave her when she was born. She was afraid she'd forget it on her trip to Stormwind, so she left it behind. It's one of the few things of my old life that I have, and I wanted to share that with her.
Elsie beamed at her friend, letting his pleasure and anticipation be hers just a little bit. She looked around contentedly. Although many on the council had met with rejection on their first, or sometimes second or third attempts to contact the living, every member finally did find someone who would agree to come. It was going to be a memorable day.
She's not here yet, Parqual continued. I wonder if she had second thoughts about coming.
I don't see why she would tell us she would come and then not, Elsie said.
As she looked around, she noticed that Annie Lansing had a basket of sachets, flowers in full bloom, and scarves, and she was allowing council members to make a selection. Annie had no jawbone, and she currently had a pretty green scarf wrapped around the lower part of her face.
"Oh, that's such a nice thing Annie is doing," Elsie exclaimed. "It's going to be difficult for our loved ones to see what's happened to us. A scarf or a sachet will help."
Some Forsaken had survived their time with death better than others. A gentling of their decomposition would assist the Alliance members in seeing past the body, which had endured so much, so they could focus instead on the person.
"That's a fine idea."
Parkwall's face was not too disfigured, and carefully chosen trousers and a jacket covered his exposed bones. But he was aware that to the living, he might not smell particularly pleasant.
"I think I'll get myself a sachet."
"You'd better hurry. They look very popular."
Elsie smiled as Parkwall, clutching Brownie Bear, shuffled off quickly toward the thronged Annie. Elsie turned her attention to the ramparts of the Great Wall and the line of archers atop them. When one of them turned around, Elsie started as she realized that these women, strong and lithe and still beautiful even in their undeath, could only be Sylvanas' elite Dark Rangers. They stood as still as if carved from stone, their quivers full of arrows, their bows held in one hand. Only their cloaks and their long hair moved in the breeze. Nathanos Blightcaller was atop the wall as well, talking quietly to them. He met Elsie's gaze and nodded to her. She nodded back.
"There she is,"
someone called, and Elsie turned. The Dark Lady was coming. Sylvanas rode atop one of the bats, her white gold hair and glowing red eyes marking her as unmistakably as her bearing. The bat came in for a landing, and Sylvanas leaped gracefully from its back. No stiff movement of bone or sloughing skin for her. Her face was smooth, with high cheekbones, and her movements were as lithe as they had been when she yet breathed. Elsie felt an overwhelming sense of gratitude that her leader was here to support them, even though Sylvanas had concerns. The fire-red gaze swept the small crowd and alighted on Elsie.
"Ah, Prime Governor," Sylvanas said. "It is good to see you again. I trust that no one has forgotten the procedure I outlined for what is to come."
Forgotten? Elsie had it emblazoned on her mind, and she was certain everyone else did too. No one wanted to jeopardize future meetings by causing anything to go wrong at today's. Sylvanas turned and pointed at the figures on the wall.
"A few reminders, just in case. These archers are here for your protection. Anduin has the same number along the ramparts of Stromgar Keep. You already know Archbishop Alonsus Fowl. He and another priest will be accompanying the Alliance humans as they head toward the meeting site, which will be halfway between the fortresses. They will be moving about with you to facilitate conversations, and to monitor them."
Her gaze roamed over the assembled council members.
"When you engage with your Alliance counterparts, you will speak of nothing other than your past history with them. You will not discuss your existence with me in the Undercity. They will not discuss their current lives either. Fowl and the other priest have agreed that if they happen upon anyone, Forsaken or human, indulging in such conversations, or indeed anything that could smack of treason or disrespect to the other side, those parties will receive a reminder, a second time, and they will be escorted off the field. Treat the Archbishop and the priest with appropriate courtesy and obey them. Dawn is almost here. Once day breaks, if we are prepared, I will sound the horn once, and you may take the field. You will have until dusk. If for any reason I deem it necessary to call a halt to the meeting, I will sound the horn again three times and erect the Forsaken banner. Should this happen, return immediately."
Elsie wanted to know how immediately was. Surely if one wanted to express a final word of caring, or perhaps even an embrace if the Alliance member was brave enough, that was not a treasonous action. But one did not question the Dark Lady.
"When the meeting has concluded, the horn will alert you that it is time to come home," Sylvanas finished. "Is that understood?"
One obeyed, especially in this situation, in which misconduct or even a simple misunderstanding on either side could mean a fresh outbreak of war that, well, no one needed that right now, certainly. So Elsie stayed silent.
When the horn blew, her people would say farewell and return right away. It was clear-cut and brooked no disagreement. There was the soft thudding of hooves on grass as one of Sylvanus's dark rangers led a bony horse to the dark lady. She nodded and took the reins, then returned her glowing gaze to her subjects.
I ride now to meet with the young human king. I do this for you, because you are forsaken. I will not be long, and then you may go forth and meet the humans who had once been part of your former life. You will see if they still have a place in your current existence.
She paused, and when she spoke again, Elsie thought she heard threads of regret lacing the words.
You should prepare for great disappointment. Though they may try, the living cannot truly understand us. Only we can. Only we know. But you have asked this of me, and so I give it to you. I will return shortly.
Without another word, she swung herself into the saddle and turned the skeletal horse's head. Alone, weaponless, Sylvanus Windrunner, the Dark Lady of the Forsaken, the Banshee Queen, rode to meet the King of Stormwind. Elsie had never felt prouder to be a Forsaken.
Chapter 30. Arathi Highlands.
Anduin had seen Lady Sylvanus Windrunner before, of course. All the major political figures in Azeroth had assembled in the Temple of the White Tiger to witness judgment passed on Garrosh Hellscream. He suspected, but did not know for certain, that she had been involved with the plot against Hellscream's life. Certainly he wouldn't put it past her. Sylvanus, she who was dead and yet lived, had no compunctions about ending the lives of others. There was no question in Anduin's mind that forbidding Gen to accompany him to this meeting had been the right thing. Greymane had proved a worthy and valuable ally, and he had been open about his affection toward Anduin. But there were some positions you just didn't put someone in. So close to the person Gen hated more than anyone in the world was one such. Anduin trusted Gen and was fond of him, but he knew that here, but a few paces away from his enemy, Gen probably would have attacked. And whether Gen died or Sylvanus did, war would have broken out at the worst possible time. Anduin did not need Charlemagne, or even the more familiar mace, Fearbreaker. His weapon was the light, and of course Sylvanus was deadly enough without a bow. All she needed to do was open her mouth and utter a wail, and he would perish. As he rode the white-coated reverence along the soft earthen road toward the meeting site, a small hill midway between their respective fortresses, he saw a still tiny shape approaching. Sylvanus was mounted on one of her unnerving skeletal steeds. Reverence's nostrils flared as he caught the scent of death and decay, but true to his name, the horse didn't falter. He was a trained war mount. Ordinary horses would be unsettled by the scent of blood or bodies. They would avoid stepping on other creatures if possible, not war horses. In battle, Reverence would be an extension of Anduin, and an additional weapon, running down enemies and trampling them underfoot. The horse was trained to act counter to his instincts. As I have been, Anduin thought, we are both prepared to go against our natures if we must. He continued to draw closer to the Banshee Queen. He could see her more clearly now. Sylvanus had come unarmed, as he had demanded they both be. He could see her red eyes glowing beneath the hood she wore, her skin a muted blue-green, not at all out of place in the somber, drizzly land, the marks under her eyes looking oddly like tear stains. She was beautiful and deadly, as beautiful and deadly as the flowers of the toxic herb Maiden's Anguish. Emotions tumbled within him at the sight. Apprehension, hope, and at the foremost, anger. Bane had told him that Vol'jin had ordered the retreat. Sylvanus had carried it out. But had Vol'jin done so, really? Had there truly been no alternative? Had Sylvanus betrayed his father and left him and everyone on that airship to die? And if she had, should Anduin even be talking peace with her now? The words he had said so recently about Varian Wrynn to the gathered crowd at Lion's Rest came back to him. He knew that no one, not even a king, is more important than the Alliance. Anduin did too. If all went well today, the Alliance could soon be safer than it ever had been,
Whatever Sylvanas had or had not done, Anduin was certain that this was the right path. And sometimes the right path was a painful and dangerous one. They came within 10 feet of each other and brought their mounts to a halt. For a long moment, they simply took each other's measure. The only sounds were the soft sigh of the wind that stirred both gold and silvery hair, the stamp of Reverence's hooves, and the creak of the saddle as the great horse shifted. Sylvanas and her undead mount stayed perfectly, unnaturally still. Then impulsively, Anduin swung himself down and took a few steps toward Sylvanas. She raised a brow. After a pause, she emulated him, walking almost languidly until they were less than a yard apart. Anduin broke the silence. "War chief," he said, and nodded acknowledgement. "Thank you for honoring my request." "Little lion," she said, in that throaty, strangely echoing tone that the Forsaken had. The term stung more than it ought to. Aaron, the brave dwarf who had died trying to save lives, had called him that with warmth. He did not like Sylvanas twisting that memory to an insult. "King Anduin Rin," he said, "and not so little anymore. You would do well not to underestimate me." She smirked slightly. "You are still small enough. I'm sure we have better use of our time than to stand here flinging insults." "I do not." She was enjoying this. He imagined that to her he did appear small. After all, by her actions at the Broken Shore, ordered or not, she had sealed Varian's death. What was the sun to her but a speck, a flea, a minor inconvenience? "Yes, you do," he said, not allowing himself to be baited. "You are the war chief of the Horde. Its members fought bravely against the Legion, and the people closest to you, the Forsaken, have asked something of you that means much to them, and you have listened." She met his gaze implacably. He had no idea if he was getting through to her. Most likely not, he thought ruefully, but that was not why he had come here today. "This is not an offer of peace," he continued, "merely a ceasefire for a 12-hour period." "So you said in your letter, and I responded that I agreed to your terms. Why are we having this conversation?"
"Because I wanted to see you in person," the king replied. "I want to hear from your own lips that no member of the Alliance will be harmed."
She rolled her eyes. "Does your precious light tell you if someone is lying?" "I'll know," he said simply. That wasn't exactly true. He thought he would know. He believed he would know, but he wasn't certain. The light was not a sword. A sharp blade could always be relied on to cut flesh if the blow was struck a certain way. The light was more nebulous. It responded to faith, not just skill. And oddly, it was because of that that he trusted it even more than Charlemagne. Something flickered on her face, and then was gone. She lifted her chin slightly as she replied, "Do you not trust me to keep my word, then?" He shrugged. "You've gone back on it before." There it was. Varian's death. Sylvanas didn't reply at once. Then, almost courteously, she said, "I give you my word. As the Dark Lady of the Forsaken and as War Chief of the Horde, no member of the Alliance will come to harm by any member of the Horde today, including me. Does that satisfy you, Your Majesty?" There was an extra emphasis on the last two words. She was not showing respect by using them. She was using his new position as a not-so-subtle knife between the ribs. Because they both knew that in a better world it would have been Varian Wren speaking with her, and this meeting would have been less fraught with tension, resentment, and mistrust. Anduin spoke before he could stop himself. "Did you betray my father?" Sylvanas stiffened. Anduin's heart sped up, slamming against his chest. It was not a question he had intended to ask, but it was the one he needed to. He had to know. Had to know if Ghen Greymane was right, if Sylvanas had set up his father and the Alliance army to die. The words were out there. Sylvanas stood motionless as a stone, her face expressionless. Her chest did not rise and fall with breath. Her heart did not pump blood. But even so, she was shocked that the boy had the courage to confront her so bluntly and so quickly. She had not given much thought to the events of the Broken Shore. There had been so much else to seize her attention, and she was not one for rumination. But now her thoughts flew back to that bloody, chaotic moment, as if she again stood on that rise, with the Alliance army below her fighting fiercely, while the Horde gave all its mighty heart to the attack. "We make our stand here," she had told the archers. And so they had, firing arrow after arrow like a deadly rain, a storm upon the loathed, fell-fueled enemy. And it was working. The Legion came, wave after wave of demonic monstrosities, each more horrible and horrifying than the last. But Varian's people were good, as were her own. The bellow of surprise and warning had caused her to whirl. Sylvanas had watched, stunned as a flood of demons poured through the gap behind her. She beheld Thrall, mighty warrior and shaman, the founder of the current Horde, on his knees, his green body trembling with the simple effort of trying to get to his feet. Bane stood over him, savagely defending his friend. Shock paralyzed her for a moment. And then her war chief's words.
"They're coming from behind. Cover the flank."
The spear, that awful spear piercing Vol'jin's torso as he shouted out his order. It should have killed him immediately, but Vol'jin was not ready to die. Not yet. Purpose fueled him. He slew his killer and continued to fight, growing weaker before her eyes. Before Sylvanas knew it, she was on her horse, riding toward her leader, scooping him up to get him off the battlefield to safety. In what must have been an agonizing effort, the troll turned and looked up at her. He whispered the order to her, his voice too weak for others to hear over the din of furious battle.
"Do not let the Horde die this day."
It was a direct command from her war chief, and it was the right one. The Alliance effort below, valiant as it was dependent on Horde assistance. If the Horde retreated now, Varian's army would fall. But if the Horde stayed and fought, then both armies would fall. Sylvanas had closed her eyes, each option unacceptable to her. But she made the only choice she could, obeying the will of the war chief, who would later die from the poisoned spear, and, to everyone's astonishment, appoint Sylvanas Windrunner as the leader of the Horde. She lifted the horn to her lips and sounded the retreat. She had told no one of the regret she had felt when, standing on the stern of her ship, she beheld the green smoke of the explosion below, where Varian had fallen, and wondered if she was watching the final, excruciating moments of a mighty warrior. Sylvanas would tell no one of that now, either. But as she stood before the young king, she could see traces of his father in him that had come with the last few years. Not just physically, in Anduin's increased height and more muscled physique, or even in the strong line of a determined jaw. She saw Varian in his bearing. "Did you betray my father?" Later she would question her choice in responding. But in this moment, she had no desire to offer falsehood.
"Varian Rin's destiny was set in stone, little lion. The Legion's numbers would have seen to that whatever choice I made that day."
His blue eyes searched hers for the lie. He found none. Something about him relaxed ever so slightly. He nodded. "What happens here today benefits both the Horde and the Alliance. I am glad you have agreed to honor this ceasefire. I hereby swear to you that I too will abide by it, and no member of the Horde will come to harm by any Alliance hand this day." He inclined his head in acknowledgement as he mirrored her words, adding, "Including mine."
"Then we have nothing more to say."
He shook his golden head. "No, we don't. And I regret that. Perhaps another day we will meet again and speak of other things that could help both our peoples." Sylvanas allowed herself a small smile.
"I doubt that very much."
Without another word, Sylvanas turned, offering him a clear shot at her back, leaped into the saddle of her undead steed, and galloped down the path the way she had come. Chapter 31. Arathi Highlands, Stromgarde Keep. Despite the harsh words from the Horde leader as she left, Anduin felt hopeful. He believed her. Legion forces had been appearing everywhere, Gen had told him. If Horde soldiers had been surprised on that ridge, and Anduin believed Bane's report that they had, it was not unreasonable to suppose that remaining there would have doomed them and the Alliance. He had thought he would never know the real, full story. But if things went well today, and in future such encounters, then perhaps many questions could be answered, and not just his. A squire stepped forward and took Reverence's reins as the king slipped from the horse's back.
"You're back in one piece," Gen observed.
"Don't sound so disappointed," Anduin joked.
"It went well then," Turalyon said.
Anduin sobered as he regarded the paladin. He was as much a personal hero to the young king as Fowl was. Turalyon loved a woman who skirted the line between the void and the light, whose sister was the one with whom he had just met. "Yes," he said, "it did." He made a decision on the spot. "I asked her about father," he told Gen. "She said there was nothing she could have done to save him. And I believe her."
"Of course she would say that," Gen scoffed. "Anduin," he shook his head. "Sometimes you are simply too naive. I fear that something is going to come along and beat that out of you one of these days."
"I'm not naive. This felt true." Gen continued to scowl, but Turalyon nodded.
"I understand."
Anduin stepped between them, clapping each of them on a shoulder. "Let's begin. There are people anxious to be with their families."
"I'll tell the priests to stand ready by the griffins," Turalyon said.
"May they be needed only for blessings," Anduin thought, but did not say. Aloud, he said only, "Thank you, Turalyon." He moved forward, looking at the 19 people who stood waiting. On their faces were expressions of apprehension and excitement. Their king understood both emotions completely. "It is time," he said. "May today be a day of change, of connection, of hope, and looking forward to a day where reuniting with loved ones becomes a commonplace occurrence, rather than a historic one. You will be watched, and will be protected." They had been blessed by two priests already, but this benediction would be from their king. He lifted his hands and called down the light upon those gathered. Eyes closed, lips turned up in soft smiles, and he could feel calmness settle on those present, including himself. "Light be with you," Anduin said. He looked first at Archbishop Fowl, who put a hand on his unbeating heart and bowed, then at Kalia, who had stayed up with him all night distracting him with stories. She smiled, her eyes shining. This moment was as much for them as it was for the active participants. He nodded to Turalyon, who bowed his head, and waved to Gen Greymane. Anduin's chief advisor's glower had not lifted since their arrival, but he nodded now and shouted orders. What remained of the enormous wooden doors creaked and shuddered open. Anduin recalled his conversation with Turalyon. The paladin had said that they would all be battling not for property or riches, but for the hearts and minds of the future. For a moment, the group simply stood. Then one of them, Philia, shouldered her way through the crowd and began striding forward boldly, her body straight, her jaw set, her booted feet traveling swiftly over the green sward. As if it was a signal the others had been awaiting, they started moving too, some with quicker paces than others. No one was allowed to break into a run lest someone mistake haste for danger, but they flowed out of the gate and toward the cluster of shapes that were now coming out of Thoradin's wall. Over the sounds of conversation, a happy laugh rang out, sounding kind and strangely hollow. It was Archbishop Thal, and suddenly Anduin found joyful tears stinging his eyes. "You led the army of the light, Turalyon," Anduin thought, and his heart lifted. "But this is the army of hope." Olema kept wondering if this was truly happening, or if it was just one of her daydreams. She decided that the pain in her joints as she walked across the soft grass at a much more rapid pace than usual proved that it was indeed a reality. Emma walked a great deal on a daily basis, carrying water back from the well to her small, tidy home, so endurance was not the problem. Speed was. She wanted so badly to be like Philia and all but run toward the center of the field, but her age would not permit her. She told herself that Jem, Jack, and Jake doubtless had learned patience in their time as undead. They could wait a few more moments to see her. She was the one who didn't want to wait. Someone fell in step beside her. He carried a beautifully crafted helm and introduced himself as Osric Strang.
"I'm Emma Fellstone," Emma said,
That looks mighty heavy.
Osric, a powerfully muscled man with red hair and a beard, laughed.
Heavy enough to do its job. I made this for the person I'm going to see today. Tomas was like a brother to me. We used to argue over who made the best armor when we served as guards. Him and Lordaeron, me and Stormwind. I thought him lost forever that horrible day.
Osric gestured to the helm.
I thought if he'd survived being turned into a Forsaken with his brain intact, I'd better do what I could to keep it that way.
He smiled down at her.
Who are you going to see?
My boys, Emma replied.
She could hear the smile in her voice.
All three of them. They were in Lordaeron when...
She couldn't finish. Osric regarded her with deep sympathy.
I'm so sorry you lost them. But I'm very glad they joined the council so you can see them again.
Oh, I am too, Emma said. You have to focus on what you have, don't you?
That you do.
The armorer shifted the helm to the crook of one arm and extended the other to Emma.
It can be a bit tricky walking over this terrain. Hang on to me.
Such a good boy, she thought as she gratefully did so. Just like mine. The meeting site, exactly midway between Stromgard Keep and Thoradin's Wall, had been prepared for the event. There were two tables, one on each side. One was where the Horde could put gifts for the Alliance, and the other was where the Alliance could place their own gifts. Osric walked up to the Alliance table and set down the helm, then rejoined Emma. The priestess who had interviewed them smiled winningly beneath her hood at the assembled participants, then asked them to form a long line facing their Horde counterparts. Earlier, the weather had been damp and cold, the sky overcast. Now, though, the clouds were disappearing and sunlight peeked out. As everyone moved into position, Emma looked about anxiously for her sons. With a pang of worry, she wondered if she would even be able to recognize them. Although she had met Archbishop Fowl, Emma wasn't fully prepared for how bad some of the Forsaken looked. No one would mistake them for living beings, and the sunlight was not kind to them. Bones jutted through green-gray skin, their eyes glowed eerily, and they hunched and shuffled as they walked. Well, she told herself, my skin is all wrinkled, and I sometimes hunch and shuffle too. There was a long silence. Archbishop Fowl moved forward.
If you wish to leave now, you may do so,
he said in that strange but pleasant voice. At first no one moved, but then Emma saw about four or five humans, their faces shocked and almost as gray as those of the Forsaken, turn and hasten back toward the keep. One of those who had been rebuffed cried out after a departing figure in a hollow voice that held a world of sorrow. The others stood for a moment, then turned and began the long walk the way they had come, their heads bowed. Oh, those poor things, Emma thought.
Anyone else?
Fowl inquired. There were none.
Excellent. When I call your name, please step forward to me. You will be joined by your loved one, and you may then roam the field together freely.
He unrolled a parchment and read.
Emma Fellstone.
Emma's heart surged. To Osric, she queried in a shaking voice.
Is it time for me to see them now? After so long?
If you like, said the priestess. If you don't, you can return to the keep. Emma shook her head.
Oh, no. No, no, I won't disappoint them like those other folks.
Osric patted her hand reassuringly, and Emma pulled away, straightened, and made her way unaided to where Fowl stood.
Jem, Jack, and Jake Fellstone, the Archbishop called.
Three tall Forsaken stepped forward from their own line, advancing hesitantly. Emma stared at them as they approached. They had all been so large and fit in life, such strong young men. How confident they had been, how proud to serve Lordaeron. Now they were but skin and bones and limp, clotted hair. It took her a moment to read their expressions. Her sons, once laughing and confident, looked frightened. They are more afraid here in front of me than on a battlefield, Emma realized. And then all the differences between her and them suddenly didn't matter. She started to weep, even though she felt her mouth curve in an enormous smile.
My boys, she said. Oh, my boys.
Mama,
Jack said, lurching toward her.
We've missed you so much,
Jem said, and Jake simply bowed his head, overcome with the moment. Then all three of the Forsaken bent to embrace their mother. Thank you, Kalia said to the light, as she watched the matriarch of the reunited family shed tears of joy. Thank you for this. She listened, smiling as other names were called. They stepped forward, hesitant or joyful. Some simply shook their heads, and unable to take the final steps now that the moment had come, returned in silence, leaving their forsaken loved ones standing alone until they too turned away and went back to the wall. Kalia prayed for them, the ones who had refused and the ones who had been rebuffed. All were hurting. All needed the light's blessing. But there were surprisingly few of them. Most of the reunions were cautious at first, stilted, awkward. But that was all right, too.
Filioth Fintalus,
read the Archbishop. Filia was in the very forefront, and she had spotted her father Parqual already. At the sound of her name, she ran right up to him, shouting,
Papa!
These two needed no urging or mediating. They hastened to each other, stopping just short of touching, and both wore smiles as large as Kalia's heart felt.
It's really you,
Filia said, putting so much into the single word. After the first few reintroductions, things flowed much more smoothly and swiftly. Not all the reunions were as joyful and easy as others, but they were talking. Forsaken and human were talking. Who could have ever believed that this moment would happen? One man, one king, had. And if this could happen, perhaps more could too. More events that should have happened, but that Arthas had so tragically destroyed. There is such a thing as a new beginning, she thought, for all of us. Foul stepped beside her.
These eyes have seen so much pain. How delightful after everything that has happened, that they can still behold this.
Do you think there will be another gathering? Kalia asked.
I hope so, but that rests entirely with Sylvanas. Perhaps even she will find she still has a heart, just as these people have.
We can hope, Kalia said.
Yes, indeed, Fal replied. We can always hope.
Chapter 32. Arathi Highlands, Thoradin's Wall. Sylvanas Windrunner stood on the top of the ancient wall. Nathanos, as always, was beside her. Her gaze was fixed on the scene unfolding in the distance.
It seems to be going without incident, Sylvanas said. Any reason to believe it is not?
None that I have learned, my queen, Nathanos said.
Although I see that some of the humans have scorned interaction with those whose hopes they had raised, she said. That was cruel of them.
It was, Nathanos agreed.
He offered nothing more.
I was reluctant to agree to this gathering, but perhaps this is a good thing. Now my Forsaken begin to understand how they are perceived even by those who once claimed to love them.
You were wise to have permitted it, my queen. Let them see for themselves what the situation is. If it is painful to them, they will not wish to repeat the experience. If it is joyful to them, you will have something to hold over them to keep them obedient. Not, he added, that there was ever much to fear from this group.
It was good for me to witness this. I have learned much from it.
Will you repeat it?
Sylvanas squinted up at the sun.
The day is young yet. I am not done observing, nor will I relax my vigilance. Varian's whelp likes to appear as though he is utterly without guile, but he may be shrewder than we give him credit for. He could have planned an attack on his own people with an eye to blaming us for it. Then he would be seen as a strong leader to declare war on us. The ultimate protector of the helpless.
It is possible, my queen.
She gave him one of her rare, wry smiles.
But you think otherwise.
With respect, such a thing sounds more like a strategy you would employ, he said.
It does, she said. But not today. We are not prepared for a war.
she glanced at the rangers she had positioned atop the wall. Their quivers were full, their bows strapped to their backs within easy reach. They would attack the instant she told them to. Sylvanas smiled. Arathi Highlands Field. Parqual and Filia had wandered over to the Forsaken Exchange table. Elsie watched them happily as Parqual pointed at an old, tattered teddy bear, and tears streamed down the girl's face.
"I want to hold Brownie," Elsie heard her say. "I want to hold you, Papa."
"Oh, my little one. Or not so little one," he chuckled. "Brownie is off limits till your king says it's safe. And as for me, my skin can't handle those bear hugs I remember."
Filia wipes her face. "Can I hold your hand if I do it gently?" People thought that because Forsaken Flesh was dead, it was limited in what it could communicate. Nothing could be further from the truth. A myriad of expressions crossed Parqual's face. Joy, love, fear, hope.
"If you like, child," he said.
Forsaken came in all stages of death. Freshly slain, partially rotting, almost mummified. Parqual was the last of these, even though he'd been so determined to have a sachet tucked in his pocket. And Elsie wanted to hug them both as he extended his withered, parchment-fragile hand and placed it in his daughter's smooth living one. Elsie wanted to linger with Parqual and Filia to savor the reunion of parent and child. But there were others who found themselves at a loss for words, or didn't know how to react, and might appreciate someone to help. These two would be all right. They had come with love and trepidation in their hearts, but they had also come with something else. Hope.
"Mother?"
The voice belonged to Jem, the oldest of the Fellstone boys. He sounded upset. Elsie looked around for him. She found him with Jack and Jake forming a ring around their tiny mother, then one of them stepped aside, looking around for aid. Elsie saw that their mother Emma was ashen and seemed to be having difficulty breathing.
"Priestess!"
one of them cried, a sepulchral voice tinged with fear.
"Please, help her!"
The cloaked woman hastened over and lifted a hand. The light came to her, called down as if from the sun itself, and she sent it toward the mother. The older woman gasped softly, her pale face warmed to a humanly healthy pink hue, and she blinked, looking around for the woman who had healed her. Their eyes met, and the priestess smiled.
"Thank you so much," Elsie said.
"It's an honor to be here," the priestess replied. "Pardon me. I couldn't help but notice that you're standing alone. Did your meeting not go well?" Her face was largely in shadow, but Elsie saw that her smile was kind.
"Oh, my dear, you're so sweet," Elsie said. "I'm fine. I'm just here to share my council's joy."
The priestess gasped softly, and she moved toward Elsie. "You must be Prime Governor Benton," she said. She reached for the Forsaken woman's hands. "I heard about Will. I'm so sorry." Elsie started to draw back, then paused. Surely someone foul trusted to assist him would not find Elsie's leathery, cold appendages horrifying. The priestess took them in hers very carefully, already aware, as brave young Filia was just discovering, that one had to be gentle with the Forsaken. Their flesh was so very fragile, and yet, as Elsie had observed, most of them seemed starved for physical contact. The priestess's hands were soft and warm. The touch felt so pleasant. Then she released Elsie's hands but stayed near.
"Thank you," Elsie said. "The Archbishop has been so kind to us. We're grateful that you and he are here with all of us today."
"I'm happier to be here than you know," the human woman assured her. "I wanted to make sure I found you, to thank you for being so willing to work with us. Know that King Anduin deeply regrets that he can't thank you in person." Elsie waved a dismissive hand.
"This isn't a safe place for a human king to be. He's got to think about his people. I owe him a debt I can never repay. He was with my Will as he passed, when I couldn't be. And I will tell you, Will loved those Rin boys like they were his own."